യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം ബലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദികേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാത് വിവരണസ്യ ച. So we are continuing this discussion, the central topic that we have been discussing for the last three sessions, mental transformations, three kinds of mental transformations, as we discussed elaborately. These three types of mental transformation are called Parinama. So Parinama is the one word used in Sankhya Yoga system. Parinama. The dictionary meaning of Parinama is transformation. So how our mind undergoes different transformations? Three types of transformation in an ascending order through the practice of yoga. Different levels of concentration. How concentration evolves from gross to subtle and more subtle levels. So we already discussed the three transformations briefly, especially the first two transformations we discussed very elaborately. The lowest level of transformation is called Samadhi Parinama, where the mind slowly reaches a higher and higher level of restraining of vrittis, which really takes place in dharana and dhyana, that is the sixth and seventh stages of yoga practice. So we have to remember yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. These are the eight limbs of yoga called Ashtanga Yoga. Yama and niyama constitute disciplines, mental discipline, physical discipline, vows, and different ways of preparing the mind for concentration. So one central principle we already discussed a few times. First of all, our mind should be ready for concentration. If the mind is not ready for concentration, first of all, the concentration will not be effective. Secondly, we may concentrate on many things. Normally, we concentrate on many things in which we are interested, where we do not have a freedom of choice on what to concentrate. We naturally tend to concentrate on things in which we have a natural interest, and frequently at the sensory level. But there is no freedom in it. As I give the example of children watching the TV or watching many things, movies, or watching sports. They may have a tremendous concentration. They may completely forget everything else when they are watching it. But the moment they stop watching, they become miserable. So there is no freedom there. There is no choice. Our mind automatically flows through the sensory channels towards those objects in which we have a natural interest. Now, through yama and niyama, our mind gets fine-tuned. It gets ready. It gets refined to focus on and concentrate upon higher things. This is called yama and niyama. And then asana, pranayama, pratyahara, all these stages, three stages, which are in a way preparation at the mental level, physical level, sensory level. Dharana and dhyana are the first two steps in higher yoga. So when yoga becomes spiritual, then it begins with dharana. So samadhi parinama, which we mentioned earlier, which we discussed elaborately, takes place during dharana dhyana. At that stage, what is happening is, change is taking place, both vrittis and samskaras. Different vrittis, slowly the diversity vanishes, one great vritti arises. So I shall try to explain vrittis. Already we have been explaining many times. Our mind, or what is called mind system, or mind stuff, often translated, mental system, is full of vrittis and vasanas and samskaras that we have accumulated through actions, through words, through thoughts for innumerable lives. So these vrittis and samskaras should first of all be refined, processed through yama and niyama, and then slowly, as we increase the power of concentration through the other three processes, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, we reach the dharana level. But what the commentators, the Sanskrit comment, traditional commentators, often stress, as I mentioned many times, is the kind of, the quality of concentration and the after effect of concentration depends upon the level of yama and niyama that we have attained. And yamas and niyamas constitute mental and moral and physical discipline. So practice of non-violence, truthfulness, absence of greed, absence of possessive tendencies, desire for things that belong to others, and then practice of internal and external purity, contentment, all these great internal and external practices, and also by a kind of resignation, feeding the mind with healthy thoughts, spiritually healthy, desirable, helpful thoughts, thereby replacing the unhealthy ones. Through this process, mind should be first of all processed, refined, and then asana and pranayama, pratyahara will help. Without yama and niyama, if we try to practice any of this, it could be harmful. Because as I mentioned, asana produces physical energy and heat, enthusiasm at a physical level. Pranayama produces a much higher level of physical and mental energy resources. Many of the internal nadis, what we call the nervous systems, which are normally dormant or functioning at a normal level, are hyperactivated. We should not take place, should not happen before. The mind is fine-tuned. The mind has opened a channel towards the higher regions. Mind normally flows towards lower regions. So through yama and niyama, we are blocking the flow of mental energy towards lower levels and diverting the mental energy towards creative, constructive channels. And then we practice asana, pranayama, pratyahara. Then the new energy produced at the physical, intellectual, nervous level will be a great help, will be a fuel for forward movement. And after these five steps, we have three last fundamental steps, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. At the dharana level, what is happening is, all these diverse vrittis and vasanas and samskaras that we have accumulated, they are processed and they become one great vritti. I mean, extreme focus. This could happen in some people due to previous life experiences. But whether it is really a healthy manifestation of dharana or not, there is one way to test. One test is, do we feel contentment, freedom, and blissfulness? Or do we feel a kind of helplessness? Is your mind is flowing towards something? when the mind is taken off from it, feeling, the opposite of blissfulness and freedom. That means it is not dharana. So, samadhi parinama, which is the first of the three steps, in an ascending order, first comes samadhi parinama, then ekagrita parinama, and then nirodha parinama, which means transcending all vrittis. So, in samadhi parinama, all these lower vrittis and vasana samskaras are being processed, refined, and one great vritti emerges. So in a way, if we can develop a strong will, an effortless will, maybe the will is not the right word, but a strong natural tendency to practice meditation. A strong and natural tendency. Strong means it should be our dominant vritti. Secondly, it should be effortless. So if there is any effort involved, then there is no yoga at this level. So in the beginning, we may have to practice, we may need effort to practice ahimsa, satya, steya, the yamas and niyamas. That's true. But the samadhi level, dharana level, mind automatically flows towards a higher ideal. So this effortlessness is the sign of freedom. Where there is an effort, there is no freedom. There is slavery. Where there is no effort, there is complete effortlessness, it means freedom. Because effortlessness is associated with relaxation, inner poise. At the second level, ekagrita parinama, which you already discussed. This happens in dhyana level. So it's called samprajnata samadhi, it is called. That means the first state of samadhi, where you have a focus on which you meditate. So the only vrittis are involved. And at the highest level, nirodha parinama, it is called asamprajnata samadhi. So this is all about the three levels of mental transformation that we are discussing. Now perhaps it may be appropriate to understand what is meant by transformation in yoga system. We often, of course, this is an important theme in Vedanta metaphysics. What is meant by transformation or parinama? So that needs to be discussed. Because if any of you read higher reference books on yoga sutras, you will immediately find the yoga sutra or yoga philosophy, yoga psychology, is rooted in Sankhya psychology. So, these two great philosophers, one is Kapila, who is the exponent of Sankhya system, and Yoga, who is the exponent of Patanjali, is the exponent of yoga system. So, Kapila and Patanjali, philosophically, they had many common views. So, the metaphysical, the psychological views of yoga system are philosophically linked to Sankhya. I am explaining this with one idea in mind. This may not be meant for the beginners, but still we have been conducting classes for quite a long time. So at this level, at least, we must understand this connection. I already discussed earlier how the Sankhya metaphysics plays a very important role in the yoga psychology. One is metaphysics, the other is psychology. But the yoga psychology is rooted in Sankhya metaphysics. So, parinama has got two dimensions. Based on what undergoes transformation. Remember the English translation of the word, of the Sanskrit word parinama is transformation. How our mind undergoes transformation. Now, in any discussion of transformation in Indian philosophy, the fundamental question that is often asked is, what do you mean by transformation? And what is the relationship between the cause which transforms into effect. So the effect is called in Sanskrit karya, and cause is called karana. So for the time being, in the context of Sankhya Yoga system, which we are discussing right now, let us take the two examples, clay and pots made from the same clay, threads and clothes. Now the question arises, the cloth that you're wearing, does it pre-exist in the material cause, which is thread, the pot or the glass made of clay that you're using? Does it pre-exist in the material cause, which is clay? And what's the role of the efficient cause in the context of cloth? The efficient cause is the weaver. In the context of the clay and pots, the efficient cause is the pot maker, or maybe the goldsmith who transforms gold into different ornaments. So the question arises, does the cloth that you're wearing pre-exist, so to speak, in its material cause, which is thread? Or is it that it doesn't pre-exist, that this cloth that we are wearing is altogether a new creation? So these are two important points that are discussed among Indian logicians called Nayayika school, and Buddhists, and so Vedantins, and Sankhya and Yoga. So these five schools of philosophy have put forward very elaborate discussions on this subject. So I remember, in ancient times, in fact, the Sankhya system as a metaphysical system belongs to 3rd millennium BC. But you find many advanced theories, so early Nayayika. So as I said earlier, the two schools of philosophers who believe that the cloth is an entirely new product, it is in no way related to the threads, or the pot that you are using is entirely a new product, it does not pre-exist in clay. It has no relationship at all with clay. So they put forward many arguments. If you argue that pot exists in clay, then why should you give a new name to the pot? If they exist the same thing, then you don't say anything is produced. The pot is used for purposes which are entirely different from the purposes for which we use clay. So also we cannot wear threads, we can only wear clothes. So vyavahara, bheda, and vastu bheda means two types of differences. Practical utilitarian factor, where you cannot use clay for drinking water. You need a cup made from clay. So also you cannot wear threads, you need clothes. And not only that, if the effect pre-exists in cause, then you don't need a weaver, or you don't need an efficient cause in the form of, in Sanskrit it's called kumbhakara, the one who produces pots from clay, or a goldsmith who produces necklace, different golden ornaments from gold. It's called efficient cause. And you don't need what we call in Sanskrit sahakarika, auxiliary causes. So weavers need some machines for transforming ekuparinama, to bring in parinama, for transforming threads into cloth. Thread is not enough. So some other things are, machines are necessary. You need a factory, you need a mill, textile mill and things like that. And you need an expert who is an efficient cause, the one who is personally involved in transforming thread into cloth. These are totally unnecessary if you believe that the effect pre-exists in cause. This is the doctrine of new creation. It's called Arambhavada, or it is called Asatkaryavada. So technically, you know, this particular school is called Satkaryavada. It's a Sanskrit word, but once you understand the meaning, it's very simple, very obvious. Sat means existing. Karya means effect. Effect pre-exists in cause. That's the meaning, that's all. So the Buddhists don't admit that the effect pre-exists in cause. And the Nayayikas, the logicians, and Indian materialists, and also the Jaina philosophers. Indian materialists are different schools of materialism, accidentalists. There are many schools of materialism that developed in India around 4th millennium BC, between 3rd and 4th millennium BC. It's called different schools of Charvaka system. So they believe only what they see with their eyes, nothing more. So only 5 senses of perception and mind, whatever they together can recognize, only exists. So they also did not believe that effect pre-exists in cause. Everything is a new creation. To say that your cloth that you are wearing has nothing to do with the threads from which those clothes are made is apparently very stupid. But they have their arguments. If cloth pre-exists in cause, then why don't you wear threads? You don't wear a huge chunk of gold on your neck. You need that gold to be transformed into some shape or form. And for that you need certain machines, which is called sahakari karanas, auxiliary causes. You need a goldsmith. Now, in opposition to this, Sankhya yoga philosophers and Vedantins, they put forward their view. And their view is called Satkaryavada. So Asatkaryavada is the opposite of Satkaryavada. So when there is a consonant, then if you add a as a prefix, it becomes the opposite of it. If it is a vowel, then if you and, it becomes the opposite of it. Ishtam, anishtam, or Satkaryavada, Asatkaryavada. So Asatkaryavadins believe that the effect does not pre-exist in cause. And Satkaryavadins believe that effect pre-exists in cause. So they say that the effect is not a new creation, but only an explicit manifestation of what was implicitly contained in the cause. So the cloth is only an explicit manifestation of something that was implicit in threads, or the pot made of clay is nothing but an explicit manifestation of something that existed in clay. That's their view. So for that, the Sankhya philosophers have a very famous, it's almost like a motto, a definition of Satkaryavada. It is Asatkaranat Upadana Grahana Sarva Sambhava Bhavat Shaktasya Shakya Karanat Karana Bhavatcha Satkaryam. This is the definition. So I should try to explain this view, because if you want to study anything related to Indian philosophy, even Vedanta and Yoga, without understanding this, you won't be able to really understand the essence of it. So the argument, argument of those philosophers who are called Satkaryavadin, so those who hold the view that effect pre-exists in cause. Their argument is, if the effect does not pre-exist in material cause, then what happens, you know, it becomes a non-entity. Anything which is totally different from what it came from will be zero, that's what they say. So for them, it will be like hair, scorn, or sky, flower, etc. Not only that, if the cloth did not exist, pre-exist in thread, then a weaver will not be able to transform thread into cloth. So they say that effect is only a manifestation of the material cause, and effect is not different from the material cause. Not only that, the cause must have a potency to produce the effect. Then only the efficient cause can produce the effect. There should be oil in the seed. Then only an oil mill owner can produce oil from oil seeds. The capacity of forming, becoming, or taking the shape of a pot or a glass or a cup should be implicit in the clay. Otherwise, that clay can never really become a pot. So casual efficiency belongs to the material cause. Maybe you may use it for a different purpose. You are using cloth for a purpose that's different from the utilitarian aspect of threads. But still, without threads, there can be no clothes. You remove all the threads from the clothes you are wearing, you won't be able to travel in the streets. Somebody removes all the threads from the clothes that you're wearing. Or somebody removes all the gold from the golden ornament that you're wearing. There will be nothing. So what is the golden ornament? The golden ornament is nothing but gold that you excavate from earth and going through so many processes which are called sahagari karanas, which involve so many efficient causes, experts. And then that excavated gold ore becomes the ornament that you're wearing. So, therefore, the effect is nothing but the explicit manifestation of what is already implicit in the cause. This is the view of Sankhya Yoga philosophers with regard to this Sakaryavada. Of course, those who may be more interested, I can explain this little further. Maybe because many of you read Vedanta, so in what way this is related to Vedanta? So after that, we'll come back to yoga. Now, the Satkaryavada has got an important place in Vedanta because the Satkaryavada has got the two main streams. One is the doctrine of transformation, which is called Parinama, and other is the doctrine of apparent transformation, not real transformation, which is called Vivarta. So, if you take the example of the oil seeds becoming oil, it is Parinama. But if you take the example of, let us say, gold becoming golden ornament, it is Vivarta. Or the clay becoming clay pots, clay glasses, it is Vivarta. So Advaita philosophers do not accept real transformation. They accept Satkaryavada. They also accept the idea that everything in this world emerges from Brahman. Everything is implicit in Brahman. One absolute reality, the scent, is the ultimate cause of everything. They accept. That ultimate reality doesn't become something different when it manifests in the form of this external world. So, there is that Atman, the divine consciousness present in all of us. Essentially, there is that reality. So, the absolute reality appears to have become a jiva, all these things. when you look at things, after removing the prism of time, space and causation, then you find the reality. I mean, if you look at Brahman through the prism of time, space and causation, it is the world. If you look at the world without linking it, without associating this world to name and form, then it is Brahman itself. So Vedanta's definition of Satkaryavada is different from Yoga and Veda, Yoga and Sankhya. Parinamo nam vastuno yadharthadaha susuruvam parityajya suruvantra apattihi. Vivarta bhavastu vastunaga susuruva abhrityagena susuruvantrena mithya pratiti. So, these are two definitions here. Parinama, according to Sankhya and Yoga philosophers, is real transformation, real change. Because they believe everything in this world is made of trigunas, sattuguna, rajoguna, tamoguna. Everything in this world is in a value of prakriti. Prakriti undergoes parinama or transformation and becomes this world. That's their view. Real transformation. That's why it's called, parinamo nama vastunaha yadharthataka susurubam parityajya suruvandra apattihi. That is Sankhya view of parinama or their concept of satkaryavada. It is true that the whole world, everything is implicit in prakriti, which consists of sattuguna, rajoguna, tamoguna. And then this prakriti undergoes transformation. Then mahatattva, buddhi, then mind, and then from tamoguna aspect, rajoguna aspect, sattuguna aspect, like that the five senses of perception, five senses of action, mind, buddhi, and also gradually, ultimately, the five elements which constitute the external world. So, this parinama is real, this transformation is real according to Sankhya and Yoga philosophers. So, we talked about this, Nirodha parinama, that's what we were discussing earlier, in fact, in the previous sutra, Nirodha parinama. Nirodha parinama means here all vrittis are transcended. All vrittis. You have to remember the word Nirodha is used in the yoga sutras in two different sense. I mean, in two different implications. In the definition of yoga, yogaha chitta vritti nirodhaha, the second sutra of samadhi pada, atha yoga anushasanam yoga chitta vritti nirodhaha. That's the second definition, second sutra which defines what yoga is. The chitta vritti nirodha is the word used in that sutra. The nirodha means control, restraining. But in this particular sutra that we discussed earlier, where we discuss the Nirodha Parinama, Yutthana Nirodha Samskarayohu Abhibhava Pradurbhavu Nirodha Kshanajittanyeha Nirodha Parinamaha. We discussed this in the last class. Ninth Sutra of Vibhudipada, which defines Nirodha Parinama. So, in this particular context, the word Nirodha actually means asamprajnada yoga. But in the earlier sutra, the Samadhipada sutra, where yoga is defined as chitta vritti nirodha, nirodha means only restraining vrittis, not necessarily all vrittis. But at the highest asamprajnada yoga level, all the vrittis are restrained or transcended. That's the idea behind. Anyway, now coming back to the parinama aspect, because we can finish this subject. Sometimes, when we discuss yoga philosophy, you also may have to keep in mind some of the higher philosophical and hermeneutical aspects of yoga system. As I mentioned, the yoga and Sankhya philosophers interpret Satkaryavada differently from the way it is interpreted by the Advaita Vedantins. According to Sankhya yoga philosophers and also Ramanuja school of Vedanta, where Ramanuja says, Ishwara or God himself evolves into this jagat, this empirical world and all living beings. God himself evolves, parinama, real transformation into all these things. That is why there is always a distinction between a jiva, or a soul, an individual soul and Ishwara in Ramanuja system. So also in all these non-Advaitic schools of Vedanta, where there is always a distinction between the absolute reality and everything else. But in Advaita Vedanta, there is no distinction. So Advaita Vedantins say that this parinama is only apparent parinama. It is not real parinama, it is only apparent. So sometimes modern English interpreters have devised a means to distinguish the parinama from vivarta. The parinama is translated into the English word transformation, and vivarta is translated as transfiguration. We don't know how far this is, from a hermeneutical point of view, how far this is true, we don't know, because hermeneutics has different schools, different ways of interpreting scriptures. So anyway, now coming to the subject, in Advaita Vedanta, as I mentioned earlier, Brahman does not undergo any transformation. Brahman appears to undergo transformation. So it is called apparent transformation, not real transformation. In yoga and Sankhya systems, Prakriti undergoes real transformation, and as a result of this transformation of Parinama, the entire world, all the living beings, the entire existence, empirical cosmic existence, comes into existence. It emerges as a result of this evolution or parinama from Prakriti. But in Vedanta, it doesn't happen. It's the way gold becomes golden ornaments, golden rings, or clay becomes pots, pans, and different utensils, which could be made from clay. The idea is, you break the pot, it's made from clay, it goes back to clay. And before the clay became the pot, it was clay. And you break it, then also it is clay. Then when is it different from clay? You see, when it is standing there like a pot where you can store water or food grains. Then you say it is different from clay. Then also it's not different from clay. Then what's the difference? The clay has got two additional elements in it. Name and form. Nama and Rupa. And this name and form brought into the clay by the efficient cause. But that name and form is not permanent or not permanent. You break the pot, its shape is gone, its form is gone, Rupa is gone. And then you don't call it pot anymore. Name also is gone. So Nama and Rupa. Nama means name. We call it a pot or a jar made of clay. Different names. And names are given because they have different shapes and forms. That's why names will be totally irrelevant if everything is of the same shape and form. So Vedanta of Shankaracharya says that names and forms are only accidental. In the sense, they come into existence through an efficient cause. An efficient cause, the pot maker or the goldsmith, according to the context, brings about some apparent changes, not permanent changes, into gold and clay. Then you get golden ornaments and pots and pans. Before the pot maker converted the clay into the pot, it was clay. We may break it again, it goes back to clay. But the only time when it is apparently different from clay is when you use it for storing water. But that is only a temporary change. So it is only vivarta, it is only apparent. So that's why it is said in vivarta bhavastu vastunaha susuruva abrityagena suruvandrena mithya pratiti. You get a wrong notion. What's the wrong notion? The clay has become pot. Or the gold has become the golden ornament. So also we get the wrong notion that we are nothing but this physical body. We have got this mind. We become happy and unhappy. Anxious now, worried now, happy next moment. This body which comes and goes, and everything else which undergoes changes. We think this is real. So a Brahman has become a human being. Vedanta says, Shankaracharya says, Brahman has not become, appears to have become. So through the practice of Yama and Niyama, which is common in yoga and also Vedanta, Yama and Niyama disciplines are common in all spiritual traditions. Not only in Hindu or Vedantic spiritual traditions. If you read any of the genuine great spiritual traditions like Christianity or Judaism, you find Yama Niyama, self-control, self-restraint, non-violence, all these great qualities are insisted for every spiritual seeker. So through this and through proper discerning mind, developing the wisdom to understand what is real, what is unreal, it's called Nitya Nishti Vastu Veka. And through the practice of self-control, and also as a result of a strong desire for spiritual life and liberation, when we do spiritual practices, we can realize that Brahman has not become this body. Within all of us, the divine spark is there. Then all the external things are only temporary aberrations. So these are two different views of Satkaryavada. So I have tried to explain this, because when we proceed further into other aspects of yoga psychology, we should remember yoga psychology is essentially linked to Sankhya metaphysics. And Sankhya system believes in the concept of real transformation, is called Parinamavada, or the school of Parinama, meaning transformation, in which they say that the Prakriti itself has become all these things, all living beings, the whole universe, our mind, our intellect, our five senses of perception, five senses of action, all these, enter the external empirical world, all these are different evolutes, 23 evolutes of Prakriti. That is the central view of Sankhya philosophy. So in this Parinama also, when Nirodha Parinama happens, it is real transformation. It is not apparent transformation, but real transformation. So okay, now we can ask questions. We have interaction maybe for about 10 minutes. Now, transfiguration is a newly coined expression which modern translators have put forward to mean apparent transformation. Yeah, real transformation is called transformation, which is Parinama, Sankhya, Yoga, Ramanuja, etc. And apparent transformation means not real, but apparently it is transformation. It's called transfiguration. But it is that translation is not always accepted. So in the Council of Indian Philosophical Research, or Oriental conferences, some science conferences, some new thinkers, they put forward some ideas. So sometimes some of them agree with that view during interaction, the panel discussion. Some of them don't say, no, we go back to old Orthodox translations. See? So anyway, but we can use it because it seems to be a sensible way of distinguishing. Real transformation is called transformation from apparent transformation. It's called transfiguration. I can recommend books, but they're all Sanskrit texts. So maybe it may not be very, very helpful. But you can ask questions. You can ask questions. We can discuss the subject. If you can be present, if you can post challenging questions, it's an inspiration. It's an encouragement for me also. Serious philosophical discussion is always a great need of our time. One of the greatest tragedies of modern educational system in this country, that's what I feel, is total neglect of philosophy, history, all these things. See, if you ask a Vedantin, he will ask a question. The resurrected Christ was already there in the pre-resurrection Christ. See, if you go to a lonely place, a hermitage or a forest, sit under a tree and you meditate, and if you can become a Buddha, then where did that Swami Vivekananda, in a very interesting way, in one context, he says, where did knowledge of gravitation come into Newton's head? Not from the apple tree, not from the apple either. Many people may have broken their heads. Huge stones must have fallen to their heads, not even apple. They will go to Kaiser, they go to surgery, that's all. They don't discover gravitation. They don't discover great mysteries of nature. But in Newton's case, an apple certainly cannot break your skull, but that was enough for him to think why this apple fell on his head. And then there was no book in front of him, no dictionary, no laboratory, and he discovered the theory of gravitation. From where did that knowledge come? From within himself. Okay, this may not happen to everyone, but the point is, the same principle in spiritual life, we are by our true nature divine, that's a manifestation of divinity already in man, Vivekananda's definition of religion. Religion is manifestation of divinity already in man. So already it should be underlined. Then you understand the meaning of Vivarta, school of Satkaryavada. So we would say that the universal Christ, the resurrected Christ was already present in the historical Christ, who was the Christ before resurrection. But then, you know, different cultures, different traditions may look upon these from different angles, different, and interpret differently. That's possible. That's possible. So, that's how it should be looked upon, you know, right? Yes. There was Buddha already there in the prince who left the palace out of grief. Buddha was born in a in a palace. He was the son of a prince, a king, and himself was a prince, brought up in luxury. So one day he's walking, traveling in the streets. He saw a dead person, dead body, a sick person, and an old person. So the miseries associated with death, sickness, and old age made him think deeply. And then he saw the face of an ascetic, a saint. So totally different. So he wanted to be like the saint. So he left the place. And he had already read all the books. Buddha was a great scholar in those days. You know, every prince has to study elaborately all the Sanskrit scripts. All that you find in Dhammapada you find in the Gita. Everything. So Buddha was an outstanding Vedic scholar. That's how Buddha's life is depicted in the Lilita Vistara and Ashokasra's Buddhist. So you find, but that Buddha just walked for 1200 miles and sat under a tree and did nothing. And when he got up from that seat, he was Buddha after several years, of course. So where did that knowledge come from? Because the Buddha, the enlightened one, was already there within, in the mind of the prince who left in misery, in total grief, he left his palace. Similarly, just as gold is there in the ornament that we are wearing, clay is there in the pot that we are using for storing water, so also Buddha, the real Buddha, the enlightened one, was already there in the prince who left his palace in search of truth. So also, from a Vedantic perspective, and Vedanta recognizes greatness, the greatness of all traditions, all prophets, all teachers. So from a Vedantic perspective, you would say, The resurrected Christ was already there in the historical Jesus, sort of. But it was some kind of, it happens, you know, some kind of. Just like you need some machines to transform gold into ornaments, sort of. So a few historical events took place. That's how Vedanta would interpret it. But anyway, it's open to, we need not, you know, we cannot question any tradition. Every tradition approaches some great universal truths from its own perspective. And no perspective is wrong. Every perspective is correct. But then, can it be, you know, from a Brahmic point of view, if A is right, correct, and B should be wrong. But Vedanta says A and B both are right. Only point is, from A, you evolve further, then you reach B. And when you look back, you don't say B. A was wrong. See, when from kindergarten you go to Stanford, after reaching Stanford, you don't look back, say, whatever I studied in the kindergarten was totally wrong. You don't say that. So, nothing is wrong. Every perspective has its value. That's the Vedantic perspective. So, thank you. You should be present, and it would be a great help for all of us if you can raise these questions and we can discuss these philosophical topics very seriously. So thank you for that question. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.